And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today, we stop all the speculation about global warming and head on off to an American community that feels the lashing waves of a warming earth lapping at their front doors, literally. Over the past 25 years, the Alaskan community of Shishmaref has watched the 300-foot buffer that protected them from the impact of raging storm waters disappear. Despite efforts to barricade themselves from the oceans, there is no more land left, and now time, too, has run out. Today, we talk with Lucy Inengwak, an Alaskan native and American citizen whose town is being forced to relocate to higher ground. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? And does it even matter if I sing? If I sink, if I sink or swim.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As I put today's show together, I came across the news that Don Herbert had passed away at age 89. Most of you probably won't recognize the name Don Herbert right away, but most of you will recognize the legendary Mr. Wizard. It's strange. When I heard this, I felt a true sense of loss come over my body. I was surprised that I felt my tear ducts swell, but of course, being a real guy of 58, didn't actually shed that tear. But my age is telling as it relates to Mr. Wizard, because as a small boy growing up in the 1950s, I was one of the hundreds of thousands of kids who would tune in each Saturday to watch Mr. Wizard. And I realized almost immediately that what I do on the Wild Side News almost certainly is my own form of tribute to Mr. Wizard. Like Mr. Wizard, I've wanted to present the issues of nature and the environment with science as the backdrop. Like Mr. Wizard, I try to talk and discuss and explore and steer away from the razzmatazz and the silliness and slick sound bites that permeate everything in the media these days. And I realized this is all due to a style that respects reason, intelligence, and honors our inborn curiosity. Don Herbert, Mr. Wizard, thanks for all you've given me, and the hundreds of thousands of middle-aged science boys and girls who retain our youthful sense of wonder, which you gently enkindled into each of us many years ago. There's a chance the world may never again have time to think and wonder as Mr. Wizard so magically did with us each week. And that just may be the greatest loss of all in this thrumming ahead world. If ever we could recreate that wondrous age of innocence again, well, we're long past that. My life as a biologist, educator, and science media host, I owe so directly to Don Herbert. Thanks, Mr. Wizard. In just a few moments, we'll be heading up to Shishmaref, Alaska, to visit with Lucy Inengwak, whose people are making plans to head to higher ground as they watch this American town melt away due to global warming. But first, we bring you this week's edition of the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. This is your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and we continue to get updates from our exceptional panel of experts in science, advocacy, and nature. The world is a complex place, as you'll certainly learn in the upcoming news report. And those of us who work and dedicate our lives to keeping this whole thing going sometimes need to take a look at that age-old question, do the ends justify the means? It's a value judgment, but a newly activating advocate is taking a personal stand to do the right thing. So I want to begin today's summit with Ben Lowe. Ben?
I've got a confession. I love to travel. I love going to new places, experiencing cultures, meeting people. I've hopped an airplane for about 6 round trips each year in college. Last summer, I flew over to Tanzania. There's nothing unusual about this. My generation really gets around. We now have unprecedented access to all parts of the globe, and we've taken advantage of these opportunities. We'll hop a plane at the slightest excuse. This summer, one of my roommates is in Russia, the other's in the West Bank. I have friends and classmates that are in almost any country you can think of, even places like Sudan and Tibet. But we really need to rethink this travel happy trend, and it needs to start with me. First off, I need to figure out how to cut back on all this flying. Really cut back. Then I need to consolidate meetings and road trips so that they accomplish more on less energy. When possible, I need to take trains or buses. As an environmentalist, I am convicted that it's time for me to clean up my own act and set a good example. After all, it sure seems hypocritical to be burning up the earth by flying to a meeting to talk about saving the earth.
Thanks, Ben. And in that same vein, I'm proud to announce that the weekly Earth Summit has one of the lowest carbon footprints of any global forum, as our guests travel here and speak to you each week without having to even drive a tenth of a mile to do so. Now that's keeping our eye on the message. And speaking of eyes, I recently talked with Dr. Mark Beckhoff about the power of eye contact in communicating with animals, and Mark has offered to share his observations. Dr. Beckhoff.
One of the things you mentioned about that interaction is eye contact, and I think that that is very, very important. You know, sometimes you can invite interaction, and other ways you could repel it by direct staring of the eyes. But I think when you relax your eyes and you roll them around and sometimes you move your head very slowly, that also is an invitation to interact friendly. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a play signal. But that's another thing I've done with cats, is especially with cats who I don't know, basically you could look at them, you can break eye contact, you can roll your eyes around and certainly not stare them directly head on. And it's fascinating how you can get them to do that.
We're going to keep up our dialogue on animals and their wonderful abilities with Dr. Beckhoff in the months ahead. Animals and their amazing diversity and behaviors has a champion in Dr. Robin D. Moore with Conservation International, who invites you to join him in his efforts to awaken the world to the plight of the amphibians. Please welcome Dr. Moore.
New Zealand contains only 4 living species of frogs. 3 species have already gone extinct. Those surviving species are among the world's most ancient amphibians, having remained virtually unchanged for around 200 million years. They are unusual in that they communicate using chemicals and only have limited hearing ability. They very rarely swim, but when they do not kick their legs in time like most frogs. These frogs are restricted to small areas of native forest in the North Island of New Zealand. They are, like a third of amphibians around the world, threatened with extinction. The good news is that they're the subject of an intensive conservation effort, which is having some success at reversing trends. An awareness-raising campaign is informing the public about these bizarre creatures, and the creation of reserves and habitat restoration is protecting their habitat. As a result of these efforts, a new population of one species has been found, and other populations do appear to be expanding. These successes speak to the value of a truly collaborative effort among scientists, zoos, and local groups, and serve as a model for projects elsewhere. To learn more about this and other amphibian news, you can read Froglog, the bi-monthly newsletter of the Amphibian Specialist Group. This is available at www.amphibians.org.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Please do visit his website. If you've not ventured into the wonders of the amphibians, it's definitely time you did. We're always pleased to hear from Dr. Charles Kennel. This week, Dr. Kennel applies his penetrating perspective to remind us all that there are no simple answers. Dr. Kennel.
I think the most important thing is that if you are worried about the next 100 years on our planet, then you'll need to predict how our global environment is going to evolve. And the minute you do that, you begin to understand how interconnected all the parts of the Earth system are. You can start any place in the Earth system and go around the loop. The oceans transport heat from the tropics to the poles, and that this ocean transport of heat is one of the major drivers of climate. Some of this energy gets into the atmosphere and powers the storms and the freshwater cycle. The sun shines down on the oceans and atmospheres and warms them and is the ultimate driver of climate. The parts and pieces are tied together. And when we start interacting with the climate, we do so on a global and interconnected basis. When we put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide, it spreads completely around the Earth and blends in with the contributions of everybody else on the planet who are burning fossil fuels. And this carbon dioxide then heats the globe. On an average basis, the temperature is rising 1 or 2 tenths of a degree per decade. But that masks the interconnectedness of the parts of the climate. Some parts of the world are going to get drier. Others, particularly the tropics, may get wetter. There will be more energy circulating in the climate system. People now think that while the number of storms may remain approximately the same, they will probably get more intense over time. As we warm the surface of the Earth, the glaciers are retreating, the snow melts in our mountains are retreating, and the snow cover is retreating. And we're affecting the freshwater cycle through the melting of ice. The melting of freshwater that has been on land, such as in Greenland and Antarctica, when that gets into the ocean, that is beginning to contribute to the rise of sea level. When sea level rises, our coastal environments and our beaches and our beachside cliffs and our homes become more vulnerable. And it isn't only the few centimeter per decade sea level rise that we've seen that makes all the difference. It's when the sea level rises in the background and great storms cause storm surges to go across our land. I was just in England, and a good deal of London is only 2 or 3 meters above sea level. And so we have chosen to build much of our civilization next to the sea. 50% of the world population lives within 100 miles of the ocean. And so most of our human activity is taking place just where the sea is about to encroach on all that we have done. When we burn fossil fuels and other fuels inefficiently, we create smog and aerosol particles. And the natural winds pick them up, and they transport them across the ocean. When there's a major smog event in Beijing, it arrives off the coast of California. About a week or so later, we can detect all of those particles in our atmosphere, and at those times, they are three-quarters of California's upper air pollution. When the winds blow off the desert, in Africa, and they transport sand and dust to the islands of Jamaica, there's a rise in pulmonary diseases and asthma. And so our entire world is interconnected in ways that we had no idea until we started studying it at the Earth system as a whole in the last 50 years. And it is clear to us that nature has created a greater interconnection amongst its parts than we have as a human civilization. And it's the fracturing of our civilization and the lack of communication and understanding and the inequality around the world that gets in the way of our being able to stabilize the environment of this great planet so that we can live on it as a harmonious civilization for centuries to come. Nature is more integrated and more tied together than we are.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. I look forward to hearing from you each week here on the Weekly Earth Summit. Sometimes it's hard to know if we're making enough progress to meet these challenges. We're all glad to know that the faith-based communities are awakening to a renewed sense of responsibility to care for the gift of life on Earth in its broadest sense. Dr. Matthew Sleeth announces a personal milestone on his path to serve God and save the planet. Matthew?
The big change for me is now being the U.S. director of this Christians in Conservation. Arosha, which is capital A, capital R-O-C-H-A. Arosha means the rock in Portuguese. And the tagline has always been Christians in Conservation. In the United States, we're moving the tagline to be the title, Christians in Conservation. It's in 16 countries, and there's like three or four more pending right at the moment. But it's everywhere from Kenya to Brazil to India to UK, Canada, United States. In the U.S., it developed as a way to send money to the other Arosha sites around the world. But there wasn't really a vision for what it was going to do here. In other countries, it does a lot of field biology work. They rescue estuaries, things like that. And in the United States, there's some of that going on. There's a project in Washington State. The blueberry crops are being decimated by starlings. And one of the Arosha scientists figured out that you can use kestrels, which are really territorial, to chase off the starlings and not have to use any poisons and that sort of thing. And in the U.S., they've had a board. They've had great members and lots of very generous people, but they haven't had somebody with a vision of where it should go in the U.S. I've taken up the job of leading that organization in the United States, and there's just great people with a great vision, and they love to combine science and conservation and their faith of Christianity. And that's what's up and new with me, and it's a challenge, but it's a wonderful challenge. And I get emails from all over the world now, people, you know, pulling for us and praying for us here. And that's encouraging to realize how big this family that not only shares my faith, but my love of the creation is.
Many people are joining this effort to serve the Earth for various reasons. Some because they've sensed the need. Some because they're becoming adults and the world is theirs if they can keep it. To them, and to all of us, there is so much to learn. Dave Foreman now joins us to offer his years of devoted study and focus his attention on a great new book about wilderness. Dave?
I'm going to be a little different this week and give a book review. I'm a great lover of conservation books. I have about 3,000 in my library. And on the Rewilding website, rewilding.org, we have a feature called Books of the Big Outside, where I give short reviews of the most important conservation books around. We have about 350 books listed right now. And I also do Uncle Dave's six-pack of the best books recently. And for last year, 2006, the book that won the best conservation book of 2006, in my opinion, was The Last Great Wilderness, the campaign to establish the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by Roger Kay. I envy my friend Roger Kay. As a wilderness manager and the bush pilot for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, he has had wilderness experiences most of the rest of us can only dream about. Knowing our flagship wilderness in all seasons and moods has led him into thinking deeply, perhaps more deeply than any living person, about the host of values wilderness holds. Roger's deep exploration of wilderness values comes through in The Last Great Wilderness. I read the book on a three-week canoe trip in the Arctic Refuge last year and was mightily impressed. In a short review such as this, I cannot begin to do justice to the book. But let me point out just several features of the book that make it a standout. Arctic Wilderness is the detailed history of the decade-long campaign in the 1950s to set aside a big chunk of northeastern Alaska as some kind of wilderness preserve. In recounting that history, Roger plumbs the values that captivated and drove the various conservationists, giving us the most intelligent and thoughtful review of wilderness values in print. Conservation histories too often focus on the same cast of well-known, to literate conservationists anyway, characters. For example, Olus and Marty Murie are seen just about by everyone as the leaders and key players in that campaign for the Arctic. Roger gives the Muries their due, but brings out the other worthies of the campaign, too, particularly Lowell Sumner and George Collins of the National Park Service, the two greatest conservationists of the 20th century that you never heard of. And beyond the big players, Roger gives grassroots activists center stage. Quoting extensively from them, he shows that Alaskans, like bush pilots Jenny Wood and Celia Hunter, were original wilderness thinkers who didn't need to rely on experts. And he shows that hunters in Alaska in the lower 48 were a significant force behind protection. Roger also gives a fair portrayal of the opponents of protection, insightfully showing how the opponents and supporters use competing concepts of the last frontier to bolster their arguments. In order to showcase such views, Roger's research involved reading personal letters, hearing records, letters to the editor, and conducting interviews with still living folks on all sides. What interested me most, though, was how Roger discussed values. Evolution was the key thing to be protected in the eyes of Sumner and Collins. They and others saw that only an immense wild region could protect the ongoing process of evolution and all of its building blocks. Quote, Sumner expressed the hope that this place might always have, quote, freedom to continue, unhindered and forever if we are willing, the particular story of planet Earth unfolding here, where its native creatures can still have freedom to pursue their future, so distant, so mysterious. Do read The Last Great Wilderness.
Be sure to check out Dave's critique of over 300 books about nature and the environment on the Rewilding website at www.rewilding.org. We're happy to announce that this weekly convocation of conservationists was brought to you in an effort to prove that great things can and do happen in a carbon-friendly way. This is Sidney Wildsmith inviting you to join us next week when we reconvene here for your weekly Earth Summit. There's a chance the story you're about to hear may contain images and ideas that are uncomfortable for many to comprehend. However, you'd better get used to it, because
here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? Does it even matter? If I sink, if I sink, if I sink or swim.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.